Hello, and welcome to the podcast for adventurous readers, brought to you by the Slightly Fox team here in London's Hoxton Square. Some of the books we'll mention today you may already know. Others are unashamedly arcane and obscure. You won't find any of them on a bestseller list, and they're all excellent reads. My name is Philippa Lamb, and with me I have the two women who founded and edit the Slightly Foxed Quarterly magazine.
Hello, I'm Gail.
And I'm Hazel, Gail's co-editor.
And also with us, we have a third member of the team, Anna Kirk. Anna, first time on the podcast, you better tell us what you do.
I've been here for about 10 years now in one way or another, but now my main role is to look after bookshops and stockists, as well as our partnerships with literary and bookish institutions, organisations and libraries around the country. So we have the likes of Gladstone's Library and the London Library and many independent bookshops as well.
The Slightly Fox Network.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, now as we're recording this at the kitchen table in the office, we should warn you now, there will be noises off from the phones and deliveries and, of course, the office dogs. But as I say, as well as talking about forgotten books and the joy of reading, we want to bring you an insight into daily life at this little magazine. So, Anna, Gail, Hazel, the Christmas frenzy is over. Remind me where you're at in the life cycle of the new magazine.
Well, the first thing we do when we come back from Christmas, which was absolutely manic, is to have a good old sort out of the office and a spring clean and a complete reorganisation. And the next thing that we're going to do to cheer ourselves up is to commission the summer issue cover from an artist called Chloe Cheese, who, as a little girl, was brought up in Great Bardfield and knew Edward Borden very well. And she is going to do a wonderful image of a gloriously colourful summery picnic for us.
And it's summer issue already?
Already summer issue. The spring issue's at the printers. It went to bed before Christmas.
We're also getting a new tranche of children's books underway, the Rosemary Sutcliffe books about Rome and Britain, which are quite fascinating. And, of course, we did publish her memoir, Blue Remembered Hills. It was our very first publication.
This series of books, I seem to remember them from my childhood. Is this The Eagle of the Ninth?
It starts with The Eagle of
yes.
the Ninth.
Yeah.
We've already published a series by Ronald Welch, which deals with English history from the Crusades to the First World War. So her series of seven books is a lovely way of introducing the earlier period. And I've just had a happy afternoon choosing the cloth colours because we have a designer who will be doing the images that go on the front and he needs to know what the background colour is.
Oh, how lovely. That's the fun stuff. I want to talk to you more about that in a future episode, that whole thing of choosing the colours, because you have lovely, lovely shades on your hardback books.
It's like choosing wallpaper. It's great fun.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
And part of our pre-spring clean, as Gail's already mentioned, is our January sale, just kind of clearing the bookshelves
spring
out.
Spring clean.
Yes, so we can prepare space for our delivery from Smith Settle of all of the March publications. So we're doing various bundles and offers on all Foxed goods.
Oh, so bargains to be had?
Absolutely.
How would people find out about those?
It's all on our website, and if you call here in the office, then we can tell you about the various offers.
Oh, fantastic. Contact details at the end. Let's move on to what we have coming up today. We're going to start by delving into the art and science of editing. What's the process, and how does the relationship with writers work? We'll be joined by a guest who can talk about editing from the other side, author and creative writing teacher Sue G. And our specially recorded piece from the Slightly Foxed archive is one of Sue's this time. It's about Beatrix Potter's darkest work. Later, we will be recommending some lesser-known reads, and I do rather think by then we'll fill up this month's episode. So, editing. This is a process that we as readers obviously were aware of it. Most of us have no real sense of how it's done. Hazel, do you want to introduce us to some of the authors you've edited?
Well, I've always worked in literary journalism in Fleet Street, mainly on the Sunday Telegraph, and also I've done a stint on the Mail on Sunday on their book page. I was very junior when I started out, and I was presented with pieces from people like Dame Rebecca West, which was absolutely terrifying, as nobody was allowed to touch her copy at all. So the idea of editing her didn't arise. I also had some experience in magazines, and for a dreadful time I did the editorial work on Jennifer's Diary in Queen magazine, Mrs. Kenwood, And Mrs. Kenwood had a terrifying system of her own, which meant that I think members of the royal family, we were always preceded by a colon
right.
when mentioned in the column. Other people had semicolons, and it was quite
awful.
Did
anyone actually notice this, do you think?
I think only Mrs. Kenwood, actually, but you had to adhere to it terribly strictly. Anyway, this is all rather by the by in terms of editing, but I think that, as somebody once said, editing a piece that needs quite a lot of editing is rather like unwrapping a parcel that's covered in brown paper with a rather interesting shape inside, and you gradually move the paper away to reveal the lovely present that's inside.
And the art of it is that it shouldn't be noticeable. That's the most important thing.
Do you have to admire the work, or did the writer, to do a good job?
I think you have to be absorbed in the subject. And I used to find, when I was working at John Murray, editing, you know, full-length books of 120,000 words, that it was a bit like taking finals. You were completely absorbed by this book for as long as you were editing it, and it had to be done somewhere quiet. It couldn't be done in short bursts. You'd have to spend an entire day doing it. And you'd have to come to know the book almost as well as the author to do your job, really.
So thinking right back to the start of the process, because I didn't really have a clear picture of how this works, you only start editing when you've got the entire manuscript. Is that right?
Ideally, yes. Mm. Obviously, there are some books which get edited chapter by chapter and rushed off to the press. But no, most books, you wait for the complete manuscript. And you have a brief as an editor as to what needs doing in terms of length, because it will have been commissioned to a certain length, but it probably will be too long.
Right. Considerably too long, but sometimes, presumably.
Sometimes three times as wow. I have edited one book, which will remain nameless, but which was had to be cut enormously, and the process was utterly miserable, and the authors were furious, and I was reduced to tears.
It sounds grim.
And their dog bit me when we went to go through the editing. So not a happy experience. But editing comes with experience, and it's quite hard to explain how you know what you need to do. But all I can say is that when you've been doing it for a long time, it's glaringly obvious.
It's a bit like osmosis, I think. I think ideally you learn it by watching other people do it. And I think that's quite difficult to find now, because publishers don't have so many editors. And you have to gain your own confidence, really, about what's right, but it yeah. takes time.
And there are different levels of editing, too. I mean, there's copy editing, which everybody's heard of, which is what most people assume editors do, which is basically spelling mistakes, grammar, punctuation. But actually, you're looking at the whole structure of the book, and if it's a book of non-fiction, or even actually if it's a book of fiction, you know, checking facts, checking that things are in period as they should be, never mind all the things like footnotes and appendices and all of that. So you're constantly going between these two different, the minutiae of the individual sentence and then the whole structure of the book. Having said that, I mean, there are some wonderful authors who barely need touching. I had the privilege of editing Patrick Leigh Fermor's last book, and I really didn't edit it at all. I think I changed the occasional comma and checked for spelling mistakes, but I mean, it was impeccably written, as you would imagine.
I think one great talent that some editors have is to be able to retain the author's voice while actually making changes, perhaps to make it clearer, perhaps to make it a little more elegant. But it's a great temptation, I think, if you do write yourself, to actually rewrite.
Yes.
Then perhaps it's not necessary, and you do lose the author's voice. And that's, I think, a very important technique to learn. I think you have to be also rather modest as an editor, really. I think that you have to be brave as well, because if you're editing somebody who's got some sort of name,
intimidating,
it's quite intimidating.
Yes,
but you have to sort of follow your own convictions.
Stick to your guns.
How do publishers put writers and editors together? Is it a by agreement, or how does it work?
Often it's, if one has commissioned a book, one will then do the editing on it. So you've chosen the book in the first place. But then a lot of publishing houses also use freelance editors, and I think that's really the managing editor's job, is to try and match the freelance editor with the subject and with the author. And that's a question of, you know, knowing if they're going to get on, if they've got the right skills.
I'm intrigued by the relationship, because obviously it's a working relationship, but it's very personal writing, isn't
it? I always think we're like midwives. So the author does the job of creating the baby and delivering it, painfully or otherwise. And we sort of nurture it through the stages before it gets presented to the world. Sorry, I can't take the analogy any further, really, but...
I think we get the picture.
Getting into deep water.
But I'm intrigued to know, if you're thinking about the author as parent, obviously you're, you know, tweaking, messing with their offspring. I mean, presumably those conversations don't always go well, do they?
No, well, I must admit this, but the book I mentioned, When the Dog Bit Me, that was just the most miserable occasion. It took a whole day. It's torture.
Editing a whole book is very different from what Gail and I do, of course, in Slightly Forks. And I think we're very lucky because we have each other. And so all our pieces are what Gail calls double-milled. We both look at everything.
Yes.
And both look at what the other has done.
And we see different things.
We see different things.
We also, we don't show authors what we've done. We just do it on a copy of the original document and we send it back, possibly with some queries marked in bold. But otherwise, we just plough ahead. And very often, they don't actually notice that we've done anything.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't direct, so they don't get a chance to compare and contrast.
Well, they can do so if something, you know, if something trips them up, they can obviously go back and see what it was. And we always say, if you feel we've overdone it, please do say. But invariably, they will say, no, that's, you know, that's fine. Or they might have an improvement that we have provoked.
Yes. I think the more work that's needed on a piece, the less the writer tends to notice it.
Right.
Because people who write impeccable prose have looked at every single comma and full stop. The others haven't. So they actually don't really notice what you've done. Perhaps I shouldn't be saying this, but it is true.
Yeah, yes, now they know. That's intriguing. Because obviously it is subjective, isn't it? I mean, clearly you have expertise, but they've written it.
Yes, and if an author is insistent, then obviously you bow to them. I'm not sure we do that at Slightly Fox because it is our magazine, but certainly with a book.
Oh, that brings me to kind of magazine editing. So obviously there's the individual pieces, but then there is the arc of all the pieces within one issue, isn't there?
We try to have a balance, really, don't we?
We do.
We have to have some laughs.
Yeah.
We have to have some serious bits.
It has to be seasonal, so melancholic pieces tend to appear in the autumn issue. Very cheerful ones at Christmas. We tend to go abroad a lot in the summer. There's often a lot of travel pieces. And we try and get a constant change through the issue of tone and voice and subject, so that you finish one article and then you're on to something completely different.
I mean, you two have had to learn to do this, obviously, in the course of, you know, founding this quarterly. Now, it was the 60th, wasn't it? 60th issue at the back end of last year.
Yes, that's right.
Looking back, is there one issue where you think, perhaps wasn't quite right?
If I'm honest, I don't think so. I'm looking at the early ones. There are some sort of...
Yes.
There are probably a few pieces which are a little bit naive and perhaps we wouldn't accept now, but not too many.
It's just that sometimes there's a particularly good issue, you know. I think our 60th issue, actually. We really... Well, we do enjoy putting the issues together an awful lot. It's one of the few jobs I've had where it's actually really, really fun, you know, to do. Sorry, that sounds awful, doesn't it? But, you know... Sometimes I used to sit at my computer and think, oh, God, but now I think, oh, good.
Yes,
oh,
yes. Well,
that's a happy thought. let me bring in our guest, Sue G. Sue, you know all about this, obviously, from the other side as a writer yourself. And you've written, is it 11 novels?
I think so.
And obviously, long listed for the Orange Prize, for The Mysteries of Glass. And I think I'm right in saying the latest one was Trio, wasn't
it? That's right.
Set in Northumberland in the late 30s, wasn't
it?
So... Tell me, have you always been involved in the choice of your own editor?
Gosh, well, I've had three different publishing houses and I'm about to go with a fourth. So I've had quite a number of different editors, some of whom have been really marvellous. Let's leave it at that.
So what's the experience like? You hand over the manuscript, they get to work on it. What happens then?
I have had some moments where I have really put my foot down. I've also had a moment with a novel called Coming Home where... I was given 19 pages of single-spaced edits. And my agent said, Sue, do you really want to go ahead? Because it was a lot. But I said, I really did. And actually, I have to say, that editor did an amazingly good job. And the book was much better for it, I hope. And also, I do remember at that point talking to Gail about what was going on. And Gail said crisply, everything's better cut. And I said that to my students only last week. Quoting you.
Because you teach creative writing, don't you?
Yes, I do. But I'd way exceeded the word count, you know, by about sort of 80,000 words. So I did have to do some
horror around the table.
Radical cutting. It was a very good experience, very salutary. The most editing I've ever had to do, actually.
You need to trust your editor.
Yeah,
I often used to think it would be a very good idea if writers put their manuscripts away in a bottom drawer for at least 6 months, and ideally a year, and then went back to them.
I think it's true to say that cutting almost always improves. It's very hard to think of that as an author, I'm sure. But even if you're just removing some adjectives, you're probably doing it a favour.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Because you teach this now, don't you? You teach at the Faber Academy, and I think, am I right in saying you co-founded the creative writing course at Middlesex University as well?
Yes, with Carl Miller, the dramatist Carl Miller, but under the auspice of greater people, but yes.
I'm thinking about younger writers now. How do they respond to the idea of being edited? Certainly millennials, they're not a generation that are used to being edited, are they?
I think students now are very curious about editing and where at the point at which you say, this is my book and how dare anybody else touch it. That's very much the feeling, actually, amongst younger people. But I think they're very interested in the idea. And I do teach an editing class at Faber in which we look at the writer Raymond Carver before and after the editor Gordon Lish got his hands on his major breakthrough book, which ended up being called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Yeah.
And it's very salutary to see how Lish, in some cases, stripped 70% out of a story. And of course, we then have a huge discussion, well, whose work actually is it? Is it Carver's or is it Lish's? And then I give them two stories to compare, before and after editing. And then I ask them as their own exercise to cut their own current piece of work by half.
And do they manage it, or do they feel so much entitled that
they manage it?
They do.
No, they do it. They do it. And they're often quite. And I also ask them then to write a paragraph using words of only one syllable. And for one writer, actually, she said it had completely changed her mind about the whole endeavour that she was on. It just turned from something quite loose into a thriller.
Anna, you're the person at the table who is that generation. Yes, whether your generation feels that somehow it's more. Feel more fettered by the idea of being edited?
I think perhaps because there are so many more forums now that you can be published through or on. I think the idea that you would be told ways that you can't do that would be perhaps, I think some people might take against that a bit, because if they are being told that they can't do it in exactly the way that they might have originally wanted to do, they could very easily get it published elsewhere. But I think if you want to be a writer and you want to be a good writer, then I think a whole part of that is not just the writing process, but being able to take advice and take those cuts.
Mm. Honestly, self-publishing is a big thing now. So do you get the sense that quite a lot of stuff that actually gets published, self-published, is not edited and is the poorer for it? Because presumably that just bypasses the whole experience, does it?
I would say that invariably you can tell a self-published book a mile off.
Yeah. What sort of flags would go up for you?
Terrible covers, horrible paper, complete lack of margins, ghastly typeface.
But if we think about online,
sometimes it can be quite difficult to tell. You don't know what's been edited, what hasn't. I mean, you can tell as soon as you start reading it, of course, but in terms of sources, it's quite difficult to tell.
Thank you, Sue, for your insights on that. We'll have book recommendations later, but as you know, Slightly Fox is all about reading books which have been forgotten or overlooked. And Sue has written a good many pieces for the Quarterly over the years. We're going to hear now an extract from one of them, which appeared, I think, in the very first issue of the magazine. Sue, why don't you introduce it for us?
Well, this is a piece from the first issue of Slightly Foxed, and it's about Beatrix Potter's immortal Mr. Todd. Beatrix Potter, of course, is one of the finest prose stylists of the 20th century. There isn't a sentence of Potter which does not stand on its own two legs. And Mr. Todd is full of... it's a thriller, really. It's very dark and it has a lot of tension. Evil characters who end the book by being at war with one another. She's just a genius, really.
Let's hear a bit of it.
I have made many books about well-behaved people. Now for a change. I'm going to make a story about two disagreeable people called Tommy Brock and Mr. Todd. Nobody could call Mr. Todd nice. Thus, in 1912, Beatrix Potter opens the darkest of all her tales. Set in a brooding Cumberland landscape of crags, empty dwellings, and moonlit woodland, the characters, menacing atmosphere, and plot of Mr. Todd have all the hallmarks of classic crime fiction. In his essay on Potter, published in 1933, Graham Greene placed the book at the end of the period of great near tragedies and speculated on the author's state of mind when she wrote it. We enter in Mr. Todd, a whole landscape filled with tension, with images of murder and decay. The sun had set. An owl began to hoot in the wood. There were many unpleasant things lying about that had much better be buried. Rabbit bones and skulls, and chickens' legs and other horrors. It was a shocking place, and very dark. We are worlds away from the quiet walled vegetable garden, where two naughty young rabbits keep a watchful eye out for an irritable old gardener. In Mr. Todd, Peter and Benjamin are fully grown, and Benjamin has married Flopsy and has a young family to support. One fatal spring afternoon, he and Flopsy leave them in the care of old Mr. Benjamin Bouncer, last seen walking along the top of that vegetable garden wall, smoking a pipe of rabbit tobacco. Alas, in old age, old Bouncer is less vigilant of his grandchildren, and his tobacco has become an addiction. He admits to the family burrow the dreadful Tommy Brock, a short, bristly, fat-waddling person with a grin. And when they've shared a cabbage leaf cigar, he falls asleep. By the time he's woken by a distraught and furious Flopsy, the rabbit babies have been snatched from their fluffy bed of rabbit wool and hay, and Tommy Brock has vanished. All the dark materials of crime and thriller writing are now in place. A group of established characters whom we love is threatened by not one but two ruthless killers. There are two plots, of trespass and revenge, of the saving of children in mortal danger. The atmosphere is fraught with suspense. Much of the drama takes place by night in a secluded and very frightening place. Black comedy turns to a violent climax with a dramatic rescue. At the end, domestic harmony is restored. As a child, I knew that Mr. Todd was different from the other Potter tales. I was terrified by the fox's gloomy house, overgrown with briars, in whose kitchen Tommy Brock conceals the babies in the oven. Bravely, the rabbits tunnel under the house all night, while Brock snores in Todd's uncurtained bed. At sunrise, Mr. Todd comes home in the very worst of tempers. There follows when Fox discovers Slumbering Badger, one of the finest comic scenes in children's literature, as a pailful of water is suspended over the bedhead. But Earthy Brock is too clever for vengeful Mr. Todd, and a battle ensues in which the two old enemies take the place apart. When a kettle of boiling water tips over the snarling fox, Brock rolls him screaming out of the door, and the rabbit sees their moment. "Now run for it! Run in, Cousin Benjamin! Run in and get them while I watch at the door!" Cut in a masterstroke to the burrow where Flopsy and Mr. Bouncer have passed a sleepless night. What joy when uncle and father burst in triumphantly, bearing their sackful of bunnies. Never has domestic life been sweeter, as the reunited family settles down to dinner while the babies sleep in their basket before the fire. But for the nature of her audience, Mr. Todd would certainly have ended tragically, writes Graham Greene. At some time between 1907 and 1909, Miss Potter must have passed through an emotional ordeal which changed the character of her genius. With the publication of Mr. Todd, her pessimism reached its climax. Beatrix Potter was not amused. She had, she wrote to him sharply, merely been suffering from the after effects of flu. She did not like the Freudian school of criticism. Whatever it was that so darkened her palate, Mr. Todd stands as a masterpiece. Here is human frailty opening the door to evil. Here are terror, courage, comedy, and violence. Here is the return to social order while the villains receive their just deserts, each other.
Well done, Sue. That was such a good piece.
Lovely. And that was an extract from Sue's essay, Potter's Dark Materials. And we do have Helen Bourne to thank for that really lovely reading. It is dark, isn't it, Sue? I hadn't come across it before, but it's completely unlike the rest of her work, isn't it?
Yes, except there are these other places where nastiness. I mean, Mr. Owl, I can't remember his name, but Squirrel Nutkin's nemesis.
Yes.
You know, pretty unpleasant, snapping off his tail.
Yeah. And also Jeremy Fisher. He nearly gets eaten by a pike, doesn't he? Only just escapes.
There's little snippets of nastiness.
He loses his galoshes.
Yeah, but for a whole tale to be in that dark tone, that's the only one, is it?
I think so, yes. There are very frightening moments in others, and Piggling Bland, of course, he touches our times, this poor creature without his papers, being arrested by the police. But yes, as an overall book, this is by far the most frightening and chilling.
Did you all grow up on Potter?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
And I shall be reading them to my grandchildren as soon as they're old enough. And with a combination of the text and the pictures, and also for a tired parent or grandparent, the bliss of having a fairly short book cannot be underestimated.
This meets the experienced parent, the short nighttime story. What about you, Anna? Did you have them when you were a child? Or
yes,
have
they
kind we of did. Moved on by then?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're very much just kind of all of those images. They're so iconic. They're just in the public consciousness, I think.
Yeah, The Tale of Gloucester was my favourite one. Cherry Twist?
Yes.
Such a lovely one.
I think.
Let's move on to this month's recommended reads, beyond, obviously, the dozen or so you can find in the quarterly. Anna, tell me, what are you reading and enjoying right now?
Well, I've recently been on a bit of an epic Kate Atkinson bent. I read her new novel, Transcription, but this prompted me to actually go back to the beginning and just reread some of the titles that I had kind of vague memories of reading many years ago. So I went back and I read Human Croquet, Behind the Scenes at the Museum, but also Emotionally Weird, which I'd just forgotten how weird it was, really.
I've got to admit, I have read it, but I can't remember Emotionally Weird very well.
It's quite dreamlike, and it follows some fairly madcap, nothing is what you expect. So I would definitely recommend it, because there are some unexpected treats there.
Good thought. Sue?
It's a novel called Gerontius by James Hamilton Patterson. It's a novel about Elgar in old age, when he took, in real life, in 1923, a six-week trip up the Amazon, about which his biographers say Elgar took a trip up the Amazon.
And that was that.
But what this author has done is to look at Elgar's state of mind at that point in his life when, as he says very eloquently in the novel, my wife is dead, my friends are dead, my music is dead. Only I, inconveniently, am left alive. And it looks at him and his melancholy and his irritability and his loss of music in his life, and then a reunion with someone from his past. And it's just a marvellous novel, so I do recommend it.
That sounds fantastic.
It is very good.
Interesting selections. Hazel, what have you got for us?
Well, as we're talking about editing today, I feel I must recommend a book called Stet by Diana Athill.
Ah, yes.
Which is really about her apprenticeship as an editor. She was, of course, very well known as an editor, and she's written other autobiographical books. Stet is a term that editors write when they've perhaps had a second thought about something. They've taken something out, and then they think, actually, I think I better leave that in. And they put dotted lines under it, and in the margin they write Stet, which means let it stand. And I suppose it's her way of recapturing her life. It's full of wonderful stories. She went to work for André Deutsch, who was a fun person, not altogether likable, very, very strict. He started up in that post-war period when small publishers were still small publishers, and she stayed with André Deutsch on, you know, some pittance of a salary. But it's just very interesting about her relationship. She edited Jean Rhys, Molly Keane, V.S. Naipaul, and it's just full of interesting observations, really, about the relationship between author and editor. I mean, she said in Jean Rhys's case, it was impossible to imagine really how somebody whose life was so totally shambolic and disarranged, when it came to words, she was absolutely on the mark.
And we mentioned Jean Rhys in the last
yes,
podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Why is her guest at sea?
Well, this is a very, very, it's not the same thing that you get in a biography, but it's about her particular relationship with Jean Rhys. And she also had to edit a book about Tahiti, written by a rather elderly writer. was completely chaotic. It was given to another elderly editor who just couldn't really be bothered to do anything. And so eventually Diana Atwill was brought in, and she said she had to almost rewrite every paragraph. And the book got a very good review in the TLS, which said it was beautifully written. And apparently the author said to her, "Well, you see, there you are. I always said all that fuss was unnecessary."
Absolutely.
There's another story that stuck with me about Gita Sereny, who wrote about the last surviving Nazis who were being tried. And she interviewed one of them in depth. And she said that when she was working with her on the book, Diana Atwill said, "There must be no adjectives in this book. It speaks for itself." So I just highly recommend this book for anybody who wants to know about the process of editing and relations between editors and writers.
Thanks, Hazel. Gail?
I'm reading, or rereading rather, a book by Ronald Blythe called Word from Wormingford. And for those who don't know him, he was a great friend of the painter John Nash and his wife. And in fact, he inherited their house, which is down the bottom of an unmade track in deeper Suffolk. Hazel and I once went to tea with Ronald Blythe, and it was an utterly enchanting experience. The walls were covered with John Nash's paintings and drawings. It was the most beautiful engraved glass on the piano by Lawrence Whistler. And he served us tea in bone china cups. And he must have been in his late 80s at that stage. He came and gave a talk afterwards at a bookshop. Anyhow, he was a reader in the Church of England, and the parish he lived in was one of four parishes in a united benefice. And it's following the ecclesiastical year. There's a lot about villagers, a lot about the landscape, but also quite a lot about the church. It's rather magical, and I worry that that sort of world is disappearing and fading from view.
I always walk away from Slightly Fox with a pile of books in my head that I need to read, and the pile is getting higher and higher. But I feel we must bring this podcast to a close. If you are curious to know more about anything we've mentioned today, you can find show notes attached to this episode, and they are also on the podcast page of the Slightly Fox website, and that's foxedquarterly.com/pod, foxedquarterly.com/pod, where you will also find details of all the books we've mentioned.
So that's about it for this third episode of the Slightly Fox podcast. Thanks to this month's guest, Sue G, for being with us. We'll be back on February the 15th, talking about imagery in books from covers to text with the illustrator David Eccles.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe so that every episode will pop automatically onto your phone or laptop.
And do finally take a look around the Slightly Fox website. You can find out all about the quarterly and explore all Fox partnerships and links to independent bookshops and libraries around the country. Goodbye till next month. Thanks for joining us off the beaten track.